All right, good morning, everybody. It is Tuesday, February 9th, 9 a.m. We're doing a problem-solving session. We're stealing a little time from lab, and we're going to work on some of the alkyne problems. And so let me get a screen share going. And sometimes I know this can be glitchy, so let me know if it doesn't come up right. Everybody can see what we're doing and see the screen. Okay, cool. Let's just start with these. Let's take this first one. And what I'm going to do is not do it there. I'm going to do it in the lab notes because that's where we would take these. And we'll start our own file. We'll just keep pulling from this file as we work through these. Okay, so I use these schemes. First off, I never sort of do just single problems once in a while, like I did on the quiz. You know, on the quiz, what I did is I gave you something that was kind of novel, where we had a functional group next to an alkyne that we hadn't spent a lot of time talking about, and asked you guys to figure out what would happen if we did the hydrohalogenation of the alkyne. And this is sort of my idea of a mechanistic problem, where it's a one-off, where it's something novel. And I do that type of problem. The other type that I frequently do is schemes like this, or synthesis problems. And so when we're doing a scheme like this, the idea is to use these as models for figuring out the synthesis problems. So we'll talk, as we bounce through these and we look at the synthesis problems, we'll bounce back to these and show how these are good models for figuring out synthesis problems. And the idea here is that you just look at where you're starting and where you're going and try to figure out what reagent. Now, some people have said these are harder because you're used to being given the reagent and asked to find the product, but stretching your brain and working in different directions is really important. And this is the first step to sort of figuring out the synthesis problems. Actually, I'm going to leave those A, B, and C in there, and we'll erase them one at a time as we need to. So the first one is pretty simple. I mean, the first one, when we look at it, we just need a strong base. We need a base that is strong enough to remove the proton, and we're looking at pulling that proton that is there. And the base that we have consistently used for that is an amide base, of which there are two. Sodium amide in liquid ammonia is one way, or the other way is another amine base. Actually, it doesn't have sodium with it. Usually you see it with lithium. And this is the LDA, lithium diisopropyl amide. That base is a perfectly appropriate base to remove this proton as well. They both have pKa's, when you look at their conjugates, NH3 and HN. The pKa's on these guys are right around 40 and 45. And so LDA is even slightly stronger base than sodium amide. And either one of those, and I know that the lithium ion would give lithium here. I sort of think of sodium and lithium as being interchangeable. And so if somebody gave me LDA here in order to go from step A to B, I would totally take that as an appropriate answer. And that would be a perfectly fine answer. Okay, but it's this next step that is a little bit harder. And you need to look at the group that is attached here and figure out what's different. So I always sort of use a numbering scheme to figure out, and I know this is super simple, and we're starting simply here. But you just added one carbon. And so we need a one carbon electrophile. What we need is something that I'll put it up here, CH3 with some sort of leaving group. And for the leaving groups, there are many options. And knowing your options is always good. So you could use a chloride or a bromide or an iodide, or there are things that we call tosylates, OTS, that would be an appropriate leaving group here too. And most people would just go for the bromide or the chloride. And we're going to talk about tosylates as we get into the next chapter. Tosylates become important. And there's a whole set of what tosylates are, but they're better leaving groups than chlorides and bromides and iodides. And so they can make this reaction go even better. And solvent-wise, I generally say solvents are optional. There are some reagents for which the solvent is important. And so when you use that reagent, you oftentimes use that solvent that goes with it. But most of the time, the solvent is sort of optional and not required. And this is a case where I would say that is true, that the solvent is sort of optional here. An appropriate solvent might be an aprotic solvent, because you're using a strong base, and we don't want any protons that would interfere with that strong base. So an aprotic solvent, like an ether solvent, like THF, would be an appropriate solvent if you were looking for one to use. And then the last step here is looking at numbering again, 1, 2, and 3. We're getting a carbonyl, and we have to think about the ways in which we can form carbonyls. So I always like to think about how many reactions do I have to form carbonyls? And one way that we've seen before is to do ozonolysis. And then a workup such as zinc and water, which will split the double bond and give me carbonyls. So that's one way. A second way is taking an alkyne and reacting it with water, an acid, which is a non-nucleophilic acid, not HCl or HBr, but H2SO4 or nitric acid would be important, because we want non-nucleophilic. And oftentimes we require the catalyst mercury sulfate with this. And this goes through the enol, which then tautomerizes into the ketone. And then of course, we also had 9-BBN with alkynes and the sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water, which gives me the enol on the terminal end, which tautomerizes to the aldehyde. And that's what we've got so far. And as we go forward, we'll add to this. We'll find new ways. I guess we could add one more here, which is taking an alkyne and doing ozonolysis. And the workup. And this produces carboxylic acids. And so just in adding our ways, all the ways in which we know how to make carbonyls, being able to pull those from memory, and then trying to figure out which one applies to our situation. Now I'm doing this mainly because I'm thinking ahead and I'm thinking about synthesis, and I'm thinking about how I'm going to teach you guys how to work backwards And so this skill set of thinking about the reactions and where do carbonyls come from and how do I make a carbonyl allows you to be able to find the appropriate reagent. And so looking through that, the substitution pattern that we need is the carbonyl in the middle. And that would be the water, mercury sulfate, and sulfuric acid. And the order in which you write them, notice that I put the mercury sulfate before the sulfuric acid, the order in which you write them is not critical, as long as all three reagents are there. Okay, so that's the first one. Let's grab, maybe we'll do problem three next. Let me grab number three. Because what I did is I staggered them. I went reagents, and then I went for, in number two, the products. And then number three, I went back to reagents. So let's do this one. This is number three to be consistent. And then we'll switch up and we'll do products. Okay, so I've modeled one. Give me an idea. You guys give me some answers for part A here. What do I need?
The strong base again.
The strong base again. Okay, and that's a consistent theme that with alkynes, we're always looking at deprotonating them in order to make them into a nucleophile. And I always just go back to the same one. I'll put in there or LDA. And THF is a good solvent for the LDA. Okay, step B. Let's use that numbering scheme again. One, two, three, one, two, three, four, five, six. And then I need that group appended on number five. So this is harder for you guys to give me in a chat sense, but you could tell me how many carbons are needed and where the leaving group needs to be on what numbered carbon.
There should be four carbons in leaving group on carbon four.
Good, exactly. Okay, so if I number them the way in which I had them, those are the four carbons. So I've just kept track of this. And maybe what I could do is I could list this as like A, just to give it a different number because it's off the main branch point. And I do, I want the leaving group on number four. So what leaving group would be good here? What do we want to use?
A bromine.
Perfect. Okay. And notice that this is a primary alkyl halide. That we always want this to be a primary alkyl halide because secondary and tertiary alkyl halides go E2. And so we want to make sure that whatever we're doing here, the carbons that we're adding, the leaving group is on a primary position. Otherwise, we'd be looking at an E2 reaction. So that's an important component there, just a check to make sure that you're doing things right. Okay, now, here in C, we're going and making one, two, three, four, five, six. This group is still here. We're calling that group A. And so it looks like I'm going from the alkyne to the alkene. Now, how many different ways do we have to go from the alkyne to the alkene? So let's consider options. So if I want to go from the alkyne, what's one way to reduce the alkyne to get it into the alkene?
Using a poison catalyst?
Yeah, Lindlar type. So H2, poison catalyst, Lindlar. and you can write Lindlar, that's fine. Or the other way of writing that is to write it out that this is palladium on calcium carbonate with lead Pb oxide, lead 2 oxide. And so, platinum would do the same, Keegan. That works too. And so what we wanted is we wanted a supported catalyst in order to be able to do that. What about if I wanted to take that and I wanted to get the trans configuration? What reagent do I use now in order to achieve this one?
The dissolving metal one, sodium and NH3, I think.
Yeah, sodium and NH3 dissolving metals. That goes by free radical. And going through the free radical mechanism allows for the rotation about this molecule that gives us the more stable configuration, the trans configuration. So now we need to go back and we need to look at it and we need to recognize that I'm in a cis configuration. And so that cis configuration is going to require the Lindlar type catalyst. That's good. All right, so slightly easier, I think, are grabbing the problems that ask for filling in each of the products. So these are a little bit easier. And this was set up to be sort of iterative with the problems that we were doing previously. And so you'll see common themes, you'll see common reagents that I'm using as I'm going through these different guys. So the first one here, we've got the strong base. We've got the acidic proton. And so we're just pulling that proton, creating the anion, and the sodium becomes the counterion. Recognizing that primary alkyl halide. It's going to take you for the SN2 reaction. So we have replacement of the leaving group in the SN2. And a good idea here to track numbering so that we don't make a mistake. So we have 1, 2, 3. You can do it again, 1', 2', 3' with substituent on 2' is one way to number, or you could use letters, or you could number sequentially so that you just keep going after 3, you would go 4, 5, 6. However it is that you want to number it, and I will model different ways. We have our new bond, and then we need to make sure that we catch 1, 2, 3, 1', 2', 3', and the group that is attached to number 2. So we have accounted for all of the carbons. And if you want, highlighting that new bond, stitching the two together can help. All right, now we've got 9-BBN. And we have to understand how 9-BBN works. This is a hydroboration reaction. And in looking at hydroboration, we need to understand both what the abbreviation is for that reagent, but also how that reagent works. So that reagent, we have demonstrated two different ways in which this reagent works. One is to work on a double bond, and it will typically work on that double bond in a way which moves it away from sterics. And we want the large steric group, so this group here, which is sterically bulky. Actually, I don't like the way that colored in. And maybe I just don't like the way it's drawn. And so that group is going to move away from the large group over here. And they go opposite one another in order to try to alleviate the sterics. And so when it adds, the double bond reaches out, grabs the boron, the hydrogen bond breaks and attaches to the carbon. And we get the hydroboration mechanism. It's a syn addition. It occurs from the same side. And then in the second step, when we go through and we do the oxidation, and this requires sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water, then it replaces the boron with the hydroxyl group. And it does so with retention of configuration. So if it's a stereocenter that gets created by the boron, that stereocenter remains exactly the same when it's replaced with hydroxide. Okay, that's with an alkene. But what about an alkyne? With an alkyne, let's say that I have a big group and a small group. With an alkyne, it does the same thing. The boron will orient towards the smaller side, away from the sterics. The bond reaches out and grabs the boron. The hydrogen bond breaks and attaches to the carbon. And we get the large group, the small group, and the boron. And the reaction stops at that point. And then we do the oxidation. That replaces the boron exactly in the same configuration with the hydroxyl group. And then that is an enol. And that will spontaneously tautomerize to give you the carbonyl, closer to the small side, farther away from the larger side. So now we need to go back and we need to apply that to our substrate. So the boron is going to orient this direction, and that's going to put my oxygen attached to carbon number two. And once that goes through its tautomerization, so first let's draw that enol. Always good to sort of stop at the enol. one, two, three. And now the bond has changed so that it's not linear anymore. It's not sp hybridized anymore. It's sp2. And we have to get the rest of the molecule in here. So this becomes 1', 2', 3', and attached to 2 is that group. So we've tracked everything as it was attaching. And then that's going to tautomerize. That's not the end product. And we need to get the carbonyl on number 2. This is going to change the way that we draw it again. 1, 2, 3. This is now 1', 2', and 3'. And off of 2 needs to come that methyl. And that methyl will orient downwards now that we've drawn it this way. And this is why tracking the numbers is critical, important, so that you don't make a mistake as you're drawing it, because you can see as I've numbered it out, 1, 2, and 3, and then 1', 2', and 3', I know to attach that methyl downwards rather than making a mistake and attaching it upwards on 1, or even a worse mistake, adding a 4th carbon and attaching it on number 3. Just by numbering it prevents, or helps to prevent, by making mistakes. Okay. Let's go see what else we've got. Is this making sense? Is this helping? Cool. All right, let's see what 4 looks like. 4 is another finding the reagents, slightly longer one. This one's good. Okay. Sometimes when you're looking at the transformations, it's good just to start out by numbering them. But you have to be careful, because we've numbered left to right, we've numbered left to right, but sometimes the molecule, for whatever reason, whoever's drawing it, just to mess with you, turns things around or draws them in completely different sort of orientations, forcing you to figure out how to renumber the molecule appropriately for the functional group transformation that's taking place. Don't always assume that the numbering, just because it went left to right, will go left to right in the next molecule. Stop and think about which way that's going, just in case the molecule has been reoriented. All right, so figuring out what transformation has taken place, we've gone from an alkyne to an alkene. The major difference being that we have added in 2 hydrogens, and we need to think about what reagent can do that for us. So what do we think here? What do we have? So we're looking at a hydrogenation. Does it matter? That's a great question. Does it matter whether we're looking at cis or trans? When we have a terminal alkyne, let's go through and say that we did, let's do a cis addition, a syn addition. When we do this, we get the double bond, and the 2 hydrogens come from the same face. the existing red hydrogen is still there. And so I end up with sort of a cis configuration of the methyl and the hydrogen. If I do the dissolving metals reaction, and here I'm using sodium, and my proton source is the NH3. So the hydrogens are coming from the NH3. And in this case, what winds up happening is I get an addition where the hydrogens will end up trans. But because it's a terminal alkyne, and because I have two groups which are the same on the end carbon, there is no cis trans. On a terminal alkene. So no cis trans isomerism, which means that it doesn't matter. So I'm sensing that everybody probably knew what our choices were, but were hesitant to say because they didn't know which one was the right one to choose. But in reality, it doesn't matter which one we choose. So we didn't need to labor over the decision in this case. So either is acceptable. We could do H2 and Lindlar. Or we could do dissolving metals. And both will get us to the same point. Okay, step B. In step B, we've got to figure out what our transformation is. And here, what looks like is changing, if we go through and number it, and we assume the numbering has not changed, which is a good assumption in this one. We've added a bromine to 3, and we've also added in a hydrogen onto 2. This looks like hydrohalogenation. But it went in a specific pattern. Again, we've got to go through sort of what our options are with hydrohalogenation. If I have an alkene and I just do HBr, then usually what I end up with is the bromide on the secondary position on the more stable carbocation. And the anti-Markovnikov addition, yes, would be where I take and do HBr and peroxide. We'll leave it at that one. I was going to say NBS and peroxide, but that's a different sort of reaction. And this will give me the bromide in that position. So it's the peroxide reaction that I'm looking for that is giving me the substitution pattern that I'm looking for. So this should be HBr and peroxide in order to get the correct substitution pattern. And now, reaction C looks to be a little bit harder. Now figuring out C, we've got to figure out what the transformation is, and we have added carbons. The only way that we know to add carbons right now is an SN2 reaction with some sort of alkynyl anion. And so we need to figure out how many carbons have been added and what the right reagent is to use for that. So Keegan, yes, SN2, exactly. And it looks like I've got 1, 2, and 3, my new bond. And then the groups that I'm adding, I'll do them in a different color. Let's call it 1, 2, and 3. Those are my added carbons. And in fact, what we can do, let's style that in blue to show that those are my added carbons. And so three carbons added, exactly what I do is I take and I draw those three carbons, give it an anion, and then give it an appropriate counterion, sodium or potassium. I don't have to show how I make this. I don't have to go through the step of strong base and making it. I can just use it as I need to as a reagent. And so I can give it the counterion of sodium and I'm off and running. And if we wanted a solvent, THF for these SN2 solvents, or THF4 and SN2 solvent is a great SN2 solvent. So we don't have to show how to make it. Okay. What about D? What's our transformation? What are we doing? Transhydrogenation. Yeah, JC, yes. So we're adding in an anti-addition fashion. So this is anti-add hydrogen. And the way in which we've done that is with sodium and NH3 dissolving metals. Good. And that finishes out that one. So each step of the way, we're taking and we're looking at how we put these together. Let's see what I've got next. All right, synthesis problems. These require a different thought process. And we haven't really talked. Tell you what, we've been going for about 40 minutes. Let's take a short break. I got to go do one thing real quick. Let's take a short break. We'll come back in 5 minutes and we'll switch gears and we'll talk about synthesis and how we tackle these. Okay. Lindsay, if you're talking to me, the mic's muted. All right. 5 minutes. Be right back. Hey, Keegan, just seeing your message there. When you say synthesis tools, what do you mean? You mean the actual...
I guess they just mean like all the, like just all the stuff we're learning about as far as how to manipulate alkynes and alkenes, as well as some of the add-on carbons.
So when you work in a lab, the labs generally are specific to the type of chemistry that the lab does. For instance, if you were in a lab that does isolation and you are isolating products from marine sponges or something, your lab is going to have a lot of equipment and materials that are specific to that job. They're going to have a lot of different solvents. They're going to have a lot of different chromatography techniques. They're not going to have a lot of synthesis stuff. If you're in a lab that does natural product synthesis and their job is to synthesize molecules and they have target molecules that they're working on, then that lab is going to have a lot of these types of reagents where if you needed to be able to do a specific job, like you wanted to do an oxidation or hydroboration or that type of thing, they're going to have many of those types of chemicals. If you're in a lab that does asymmetric catalysis, then you're going to have only specific types of substrates that they would typically like to work on to show that these reactions happen. And so what I'm saying is that the labs are very specific to certain types of chemistry and will have chemicals that are specific to that. They won't all generally in a working organic lab have the same sorts of things because every organic lab is very unique in what it does. That's a kind of answer for that. Cool. Okay. Let's see if people are starting to come back. Did we get Lindsay and Drew and Abby, Kelly, AJ, JC, Lily? Paige is here. Cool. Okay. Seems like most people are sort of back. Let's go ahead and start talking about some of these synthesis problems. And back just eating breakfast, no worries. Let's take a look at some of these synthesis ones and how we tackle these. Now, the reason I gave you the other problems first is because I wanted to use them as a template on which to build. But before we start building, I want to talk about a way in which we sort of tackle these. So in a synthesis problem, we give you a starting material. We'll call it a substrate, a starting substrate. And a desired product. And sometimes you can take and you can look at it and you can number the number of carbons that are in that starting substrate. And 1, 2, 3. And it may be advantageous to try to number them in such a way as to be consistent so that this one, maybe the better way to number it is 1, 2, and 3. And we'll see why in a minute. And that means that number 3 here is sort of a new carbon. So as I start to sort of map this out, And we've also added an alcohol. And so in this first step, we sort of appropriately call it mapping, figuring out what is different from our starting substrate and our desired product, which sort of gives me the steps that are going to need to happen. So what I'm going to need to do is I'm going to need to add a carbon. We know that the only reactions that we have to do to add a carbon right now work with an alkynyl anion and something with a leaving group on it, an SN2 reaction. And then the second thing I'll have to do is I'll have to find a way to add an OH group. And there may be a couple of ways to add OH groups, and we'll have to think about sort of an appropriate way of adding OH groups. And underneath adding OH groups, you know, we could have water and acid. We could have oxymercuration demercuration, HG, OAC2 with water. And then in the second step, we use sodium boron hydride. It could be that we're looking at hydroboration, BH3THF, followed by oxidation. So just thinking through the different ways of adding hydroxyl groups as my possibilities. And so when doing the mapping, having in mind what each one of these steps may entail is good. Then my second step after mapping is I work backwards. And this is what I call retrosynthesis. And in my retrosynthesis, I use a specific arrow to indicate that I'm working backwards. A retrosynthesis is where we go step by step. Instead of going in the forwards direction, you work backwards with intention, with the idea of moving back to your starting material. And so the first thing that I'm going to try to tackle is I'm going to try to tackle this alcohol, and I'm going to think of different ways in which I can get that alcohol in this position in this way. So one of the things that I can do is I can disconnect this group and think about how I could have a substrate that would have allowed me to put that hydroxyl group in that position. So for instance, if I had the double bond here that was one, keep the numbering system the same, 3, 2, and 1, I could get that group in there, that hydroxyl group, through going back this way, BH3THF as a first step, and then as a second step, sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. And that would allow me to go backwards. And also, while going backwards to the alkene, that hydroxyls are made from alkenes, thinking about what it is the forward step that takes me in the forwards direction that gets me back to that. So I don't want to break anything or take anything apart if I don't know how to put it back together. It's like your mom used to tell you, don't take it apart if you don't know how to put it back together. If you're just going to break it, don't break it. Take it apart and know how to put it back together. Okay, so once we get in this step, the next idea is, where do alkenes come from that could get me back to this guy? And the answer to that one is they come from going back to an alkyne and a reduction. This could be 3, 2, and 1. And that I could get to that alkene from that alkyne if I go through and do hydrogenation and Linlar. Or it could be the dissolving metals reaction, sodium and NH3. Either of those reactions would take me back. And then in a last step, I can go back to this guy by tearing off carbon number 3 and looking at doing the SN2 reaction. And so this SN2 reaction, my first step would be to use the strong base, sodium amide in liquid ammonia. And then number 2, reacting with the appropriate CH3Br to put it back together. So we have worked backwards, doing what's called a retrosynthesis. And then after we work backwards, generally we don't show these steps here in the working backwards component. Let me take and show what this would normally look like. So these wouldn't be here. My working backwards would look like this. And this would be my retrosynthesis.
What do you mean by normally?
Normally, I don't take and write out these forward steps this way. What I was going to show you is that after we do the retrosynthesis and we go through and we do the analysis, this sort of part is in my head as I'm doing that. And then I write it out in the forward sequence. Taking each one of the steps and adding the reagents, sodium amide, should have been a 2, and I'll put in the NH3 there, and then number 2, I would react this with a 1 carbon electrophile, either a bromide or a chloride. Let's increase that arrow size to match the size of what we've done. That would take and add in the carbon. And then I would do my hydrogenation. And then I would do my hydroboration. And following sort of not turning anything around the way that I've done, and I've got 3, 1, 2, and 3 that matches what I was trying to do up here. And so normally what we do, and by normally what I mean is it's a 2-step process where I draw out the retrosynthesis and then I draw it out in the forwards direction. And this is actually the answer that I'm looking for. So this, let's do it this way. this is the work to get to the answer. So those are the two components and how I work that out. In the second step, you use 9 BBN hydrogen peroxide and water. 9 BBN would work just fine in that second step. So 9 BBN, interestingly, if we look at that second step that we're doing there, and we're looking at the hydroboration, usually what we do when we want to hydroborate something, the normal course is to take and do BH3 THF, and this works on electronics. And by electronics, what I mean is that when it adds such that the boron adds slightly ahead of the hydrogen, such that the transition state is asymmetrical, concerted but asymmetrical. The electrons move this way and this way, allowing for a slight buildup of partial positive charge at the more stable secondary position. That's why boron actually works and does its job, taking us through the intermediate. And then through the oxidation, we get the alcohol on that position. 9 BBN works on sterics, but in addition to working on sterics, 9 BBN can also work electronically. It's just that sterics will push it in a different direction. So 9 BBN is usually used for something like this, where I have a double bond, and the double bond is secondary, but on one side of the double bond, maybe I have something that is big and bulky, like a tertiary butyl group. And because of that tertiary butyl group, the boron will favor the side that is less sterically hindered, such that electrons will go this way, away from the big bulky group. But in absence of any sterics, 9 BBN will work on electronics. And so what happens here is the boron will still add slightly ahead of the hydrogen in an asymmetric fashion, getting the buildup of partial positive on the secondary position. And so you can certainly do 9 BBN and then two sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. This will work, and you'll get the right product. The difference is in what's called atom efficiency or expense. So if we take a look at what 9 BBN is, 9 BBN is a very expensive reagent. It's got a lot of carbons in it, and to make 9 BBN, they had to do a reaction to begin with that started with cyclooctadiene, and they hydroborated this. BH3THF, and it goes through and hydroborates. It's not, I like the first structure I've got. It hydroborates in a way that adds the boron across the double bonds, and then it still has the hydrogen on it. These bonds are both to the same side of the ring system, and that is a molecule that looks like this, which we cartoon and we just draw the parachute. And they mean the same sort of thing. And so it's a very expensive reagent to make, and it uses a lot of atoms, and you're throwing away all of these carbons get thrown away when you do this reaction to put in the hydroxyl group. Comparing that to just BH3, where I'm not throwing away anything except the boron to replace it in order to get the alcohol in that position. So it's just an atom expense idea, but they both work identically. All right. Something that I want to show you. If we take this and we look at the addition of the methyl, and then we look at the reduction to the alkene, and then we look at the addition of the alcohol, these problems are mirrored, not in that one so much, but in this one, we took and we added in a group. We then did a hydroboration. Maybe it's the one up here. This one's not so bad in terms of adding in a methyl. And then instead of doing hydroboration, we did a different step here where we did a hydration step and it went through the enol keto tautomerism. But these steps are all sort of common and we're using all the same reagents in a very similar process to come up with this synthesis. It's just this idea of adding working backwards that is not an easy idea. It is a more complicated idea. Let's try another one. And the more of these you do, the easier they get. And I've grouped them to keep things similar so that you're doing small changes between each problem. So here again, we have the alkyne. We can number it 1, 2, 1, 2, and 3. In this problem, we're adding a carbon. And we're adding in the hydroxyl. And so in this problem, we need to think about how we want to do that. In working backwards, I'll ask the question, well, I can ask the question, which one of these do I want to deal with first, add the carbon or add the hydroxyl? I think adding the hydroxyl, this one should be last. And adding the carbon, this one should be first. And I'm thinking about that in a forward sequence sort of way. So retrosynthetically, I'm going to say, where do alcohols come from? This is the question that I'm going to ask myself. How do I make an alcohol? From what? What substrate do I use in order to do that? And so alcohols can come from a number of different reagents, but in general, when we make an alcohol, we make it from the alkene, right? So either reaction with acid, exactly, or hydroboration, depending on the substitution pattern that I have, but they generally come from the alkenes. So I know that there is a reaction that would allow me to get from this alkene back to that guy. And then working backwards, I ask the question, where do alkenes come from? So how do I make an alkene? And alkenes are made from alkynes. Exactly. You are on it. And then that alkyne can be made from the starting alkyne. And now we just need to take and put the reactions together that actually accomplish these. So going forward, I need to first add the carbon. So I take my starting material and I do the reactions in order to add the carbon. Number one, I treat it with base, sodium amide or LDA in liquid ammonia. And then two, I add the carbon, CH3Br, in the SN2 reaction. That's the way that I typically would write those out. That gives me the added carbon. Then I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to make the alkene, and I need to decide on reagents in order to reduce this to the alkene. So which reagent would we like to use in this case? I'm watching the chat or waiting for somebody to queue up and tell me what they want to use. Either, yeah, because this is a terminal alkyne, it doesn't make any difference. So we can use either one. So let's go ahead and use the dissolving metals. And then I've got to get that alcohol in the right orientation. It's got to be on carbon number two. So what reagents will allow me to be able to put that alcohol on position number two? Markovnikov addition with acid. Best way to do that is to add in water and an acid that is either H2SO4 or HNO3. Those are the two best acids to be able to accomplish that with. And the reason is that their conjugates are non-nucleophilic. So when we look at the conjugate, which is this guy, or the conjugate of the nitric acid, these are both non-nucleophiles because they're super resonance stabilized and they won't interact with the carbocation that we create, giving water the time to be able to do the addition. You don't want to use HCl or HBr. So it's important here to say not HCl or HBr, because chloride and bromide are good nucleophiles, and I would then get hydrohalogenation. I would get the chloride or the bromide substituting in place of the water. So the choice of acid there is important. I'm bringing up some of those things because some of these I saw in the quiz as I was grading the quiz. And so I'm trying to hit some of these common misconceptions when I see the wrong acid being used in some locations. I want to hit that so that everybody's clear in why we're making certain choices. All right, let's see where we go from there.
Could we do one of the restricted ones? I was having a little trouble with those.
Sure. This is a great one, 5. So this is a different style where the starting material is restricted to make it an added challenge. There are certainly ways that I could do this from different starting materials that would make this a lot easier. But when you have a starting material that is a restriction, it means that when I look at the number of carbons that are here, 1 and 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, that if that 2-carbon block is my only source of carbons, then that means that it's not 3 and 4, it's 1 and 2. And I have to find a way to modify this acetylene in order to be able to make it both into the nucleophile and the electrophile. So I have to make it into a nucleophile and an electrophile, but it doesn't change the way I attack the problem. I attack the problem in the same process. So what we'll do is we'll first ask about a ketone like this, carbonyl. Where do carbonyls come from? How many different ways do I know to make carbonyls? And what sort of sources could I make this from? And you can envision that there are two different possible molecules that I could use to make this from. One molecule would be to have the triple bond in the center, and the other one would be to have the triple bond on the terminal end. And one, two, one, two. One, two, one, two. And I can envision reactions, reagents that would take me back to that material from both of these positions, right? And so from this one going back, I can envision that it would just be simply a hydration reaction. Because of the symmetry of the molecule, it would go the direction that I want. And regardless of which carbon the oxygen went to, it would be symmetrical and would land it back at the same molecule. And from this one, similarly, I would want to use just the water, mercury sulfate, H2SO4, mercury sulfate. And it will go onto the more substituted carbon, carbon number two, and I would end back at the same place. So I can go from either one of these. But the question is, which one of these can I tear apart into two carbon frameworks? So for instance, what I'm saying is, if I'm going to tear this one apart, when I tear this apart, this is going to go back to a CH3, with some sort of leaving group, like a bromide or a chloride, and a three-carbon chain that has the negative charge. So everybody see that? Because of the way that you have to tear it apart at the alkyne. And if I tear this one apart at the alkyne, I get the alkynyl anion, a two-carbon chain with an appropriate leaving group. And do you see that this way is a pathway that can take me back to this material for both groups? Whereas this one, I'm going to struggle in order to get it back into two carbon units because I have a three carbon unit that I've broken it into. Letting that sort of sink in to see if that is making sense or not. And so what I'll do, this part is easy. That's just the base. This part, I'll keep going with. And I'll take it first back to an alkene where I could do hydrohalogenation. And then that alkene can actually come all the way back. I need a big old double arrow. I'll cheat. Didn't work. That can go all the way back to that molecule there. And so synthesis-wise, what I envision doing here is doing this. We start off with the acetylene. We reduce it to an alkene. Let's do hydrogen and Linlar. After reducing it to the alkene, I'll take and I'll add HBr across it. Then what I'll do is I'll take that reagent and I will take the acetylide again and make the anion. And then I take these two and react these two together. And that makes my new carbon-carbon bond. And then from there, I can take and I can add the water, acid, and mercury sulfate. And that will go through the enol that will tautomerize into the ketone. So in these where there's a restricted carbon source, depending upon what the restriction forces you to get creative, the restriction forces you to get creative into options in how you tear apart the molecule and thinking through these options. And sometimes you'll find that there is more than one correct answer and more than one way to do things. Sometimes you'll find one way will give you a shorter number of steps. The other way is viable, but gives you a longer number of steps. The point is not to get the smallest number of steps, although ultimately that is the point. But for right now, I don't count that as the point. For right now, what I say is if your reaction is viable, regardless of the number of steps, it is a correct answer and it gets full credit. So I don't give more points for a shorter answer. I award points based on correct answers that get me from point A to point B, regardless of the number of steps that it takes. I look at the correctness of the steps, not how many steps. Okay. And there are different types of restrictions that we could do on a problem. For instance, in number 6, I tell you that you only have 2 starting materials that you can use, and that these must be your only sources of carbon, or these in 7 are your only sources of carbon, or in number 8, you have to start with this material, but you can use any other carbon reagents that you need to in order to be able to get to the final product. And so there are different types of restrictions. Let's do number 6. And see how we can put number 6 together. I sort of like to, I know you wanted to jump to these and maybe the other ones were too simple. And they do start pretty simple through those. Yeah, let's go ahead and do number 6. Okay, number 6 gets complicated because, again, I've got 1, 2, and let's call it 3, and no clear mapping. I could look at this and I could say I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that I've got 5 additional groups in there, or 5 carbons. And so looking at this, if I used the alkyne and 2 of these guys, that would give me an alkyne that has 4 carbons on it, but then it would be hard to make that 5th carbon And so it looks to me, if I'm looking at these as sort of groups, that maybe what I'm looking at is I'm looking at a two carbon group, and there's two carbons, and there's two carbons, and I'm looking at a one carbon group, and that might be my one carbon. And this might be a viable mapping. And so mapping can take many forms in the way that you do it, in figuring out how you're going to fit these groups into this molecule. And then we start working backwards and we start thinking about what it is that we want to do. What do we want to tear apart first, second, or third? First thing that that I might consider here is I only have the one functional group. I have the alkene. So maybe taking that alkene back first to the alkyne so that we can start to tear apart different parts of the molecule. From the alkyne, we can break off a methyl group and we can take it back to the alkynyl anion and maybe the CH3Br. That gets me that piece. This alkyne then, and maybe I should have gone down. I'm going to take it and orient down. I think going over was a little premature yet. I don't have enough room. I'm going to run out of room. Okay, so now we work with just the alkyne piece. And we take that back first to that guy. And breaking off this piece, which takes me to this and some leaving group. And that piece could come from there. Now I need to work out that bromide and where that ethyl bromide came from. The ethyl bromide could come from the alkene through hydroboration or through hydrohalogenation. And that alkene through reduction could come from that piece. And now I've got all the pieces constructed from my carbons. Now I just need to turn everything around and take it in the forward direction. So what I'll do to go in the forwards direction is I will take first and reduce it. And then react it with HBr to make the two carbon group. I'll then take that same starting material and make the anion that I need. And then I'll react these two together to make that piece. Then what I'll do is I'll take and react that with the sodium amide again. And that will give me a new nucleophile. And I'll react that with my one carbon electrophile. That'll make my carbon-carbon bond. And then I need to do the reduction, but I need to use a specific reducing agent in this case. Which reducing agent do I need to use? Do I use dissolving metals or do I use H2 and Linlar?
It's a cis one, so H2 and Linlar.
Correct. So we're looking at cis, and that's going to mean H2 and Linlar. And that's because that's my syn addition. And see how I've taken now and used that starting material so you can see how that starting material got built in and then the last starting material got put in there and how I use just those sources of carbon. How is that looking? How is that sitting with everybody? It is very puzzle-like. And in fact, these are puzzle problems. Synthesis like this is a huge puzzle problem. And let me take this problem and just show you kind of what happens. I was trying to not overwhelm you in terms of this puzzle problem, but one of the things that I could do is I could take this and say, maybe what I want is that material and remove it from the double bond and remove it from any ability to be able to see where things came from. And the problem gets much more difficult because now the starting material doesn't look anything like the product, and trying to figure out how those pieces fit into that is really hard. Let me draw a molecule for you. Give me 1 second. I want to look it up because I don't know it on the top of my head. And come on. Give me the structure. Okay. So don't try to keep up with me. Let me just draw this. And we'll talk about why this skill set is important and what this skill set sort of looks like. This molecule is called Taxol. And Taxol was one of the first breast cancer drugs, one of the first cancer drugs that was identified to be able to fight cancer. And you can see the number of stereocenters that are within this molecule And it's actually pretty big molecule. It's isolated from the bark of a yew tree. And in order to do clinical trials, they needed to process an amazing amount of yew tree bark in order to be able to isolate this compound. And in fact, it took tens of thousands of trees in order to be able to isolate enough of this material to be able to take it through clinical trials. And so to be able to treat the number of people that have cancer with this drug that was a remarkable drug for treating cancer was infeasible to be able to do it from just isolating it from trees. It couldn't be done. And so what they needed to do is they needed to figure out how to synthesize this. And how do you synthesize this molecule? And where do you even begin? And look at all the stereocenters that are in it. And this molecule needed to be synthesized stereospecifically, meaning you couldn't have enantiomers and you couldn't have a mixture of all the different isomers. It had to be stereospecific. Somebody needed to sit down and figure out how to synthesize this and where to tear apart the bonds, and in a retrosynthetic approach, how to actually break each part of this apart and then how to put it back together. And I think the synthesis has over 20 steps. I think it's probably closer to 30 steps in order to synthesize this molecule. And they're huge puzzles, and it took years in order to figure it out. But what came from this and the necessity to synthesize molecules like this is this idea of retrosynthetic analysis that was proposed by E.J. Corey, and a process of how do you take a molecule and start tearing a molecule apart in ways that allow you to put it back together. And so there were natural sort of areas where we look at tearing this molecule apart, bonds that are easy to reconstruct, like the amide bonds, the ester bonds, places in which we can break this molecule and be able to put it back together in these sort of pieces here, and chopping it back into frameworks. The ring framework is extraordinarily difficult to take apart, and you need to find certain places where you can make a bond. I think that is probably one of the places where they cleave it. Another place is probably over here. And then a sequencing of which of these are we going to do first, second, third, and fourth? And how do we make a molecule this big? So when we think about our puzzles and these puzzles, thinking about it in context of, oh my God, how does anybody even begin to deal with a molecule that is like that, like Taxol? It kind of puts things into perspective, and also why it's important. It's important synthetically because of how we can't just isolate every molecule from natural sources to derive medications. In fact, there's a good image here. Come on, show me that image. I was going to share this. Maybe I can print it. And then share it. I can bring it in. So there's Taxol. That would have been an easier way to do it. And what they've done is they've color-coded it by the segments in which they did the synthesis. And so you can see where they actually did their splits, where they broke things apart. Things that are in the same color were molecules that they brought in one piece. and places where it changes color is where they broke the molecule apart in order to be able to bring it back together in smaller parts. And so this whole ring segment here, they probably found from some natural product and brought that ring segment in all in one group, because they were able to isolate that from some natural product in order to be able to go through and synthesize it. But it's just interesting to see how they tear these molecules apart and why this skill set of synthesis is an important one. It's important because as chemists, this is one of our ultimate goals, is the ability to be able to make complicated molecules that we can use as drugs and drug synthesis. And they are puzzles. And these are the types of puzzles that organic chemists just love. You know, some people do crossword puzzles, organic chemists do total synthesis. That's our Sudoku. That's what we hang out and think about and figure out how to do. So that's why we start simple with these and then we build up. Okay. So I just wanted to give you some context there of we will never do anything this complicated, but we will build up right now. If you look at how many steps we started out in these synthesis problems, we started in 3 steps. This one was 3 steps. So we did 2 that were 3 steps. And then we branched out and we went to one that took 5 steps really in order to put that together. Where we're going as we go forward in the chemistry is up to reactions that may be 10 or 12 steps is usually the most that we will do. And so looking at building up that ability to go from 3 to maybe 5, to 7, to 10, to 12, and working on problems that get more complicated. And this is where those star charts come in handy, is that by having your star charts on hand and knowing the different transformations of how I can get from point A to point B and asking yourself those questions, where do alkenes come from? How do I make an alkene? What is my starting material for an alkene? Ah, it's an alkyne. All right, take it back to the alkyne. How do I get to adding a carbon? Oh, SN2 reaction. How do I then tear apart this? Oh, another SN2 reaction. Where do bromides come from? Alkenes. Where do alkenes come from? Alkynes. It's that working backwards and asking yourself, where do things come from? And doing it step by step. That's the process that we're trying to show. All right, it's 10:45. I think I've taxed your brains enough for this morning. We've got office hours in about 15 minutes. And I think this is a great place to cut it. And if you have questions, I'll stay on the line and answer any questions you have. I think this was sort of like a good session to go through these. Hopefully that was helpful. And if you're feeling lost in these problems that have restrictions, or even lost in the whole synthesis thing, know that this is just a beginning conversation. It is very natural to feel uncertain and uneasy about these problems, or even unclear as to how to even start them, that this is just the beginning of our conversation. And we're gonna do lots of these as we go forward. And we have a chapter coming up after this free radical chapter that we're in, where we talk more about synthesis and more about this retrosynthetic sort of analysis process. And we'll get lots of practice with these, and I'll keep throwing practice at you. Okay? So that's where we go. All right, I'm going to cut the recording. I'll stay on and answer any questions you guys have.